I think the best way to make sense of this is to realise he's not talking straightforwardly about Melchizedek the person, but the portrait of Melchizedek in Scripture. Everyone in Genesis who's anyone has a genealogy at the beginning and normally a genealogy at the end too. They begat, and then they died. And yet this guy appears in the scene of Genesis as if out of nowhere and then disappears and we never hear him about him again. So in a literary way, it's like he's this eternal person in both directions, having neither beginning of days nor end of life.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of White Horse Inn. You know, we're going through the book of Hebrews, or the sermon of Hebrews, perhaps, and we are able to do that with a friend who is an expert on the epistle to the Hebrews. We're going to be doing that with Justin Holcomb, a senior fellow with Sola Media's Theo Global. He also serves as a seminary professor and Episcopal minister. And Bob Hiller is the senior pastor of a community Lutheran church in Escondido, California, and is the content editor for our good friends over at 1517.org. And I'm Mike Horton. I impersonate a professor at Westminster Seminary, California, where I happen to have the pleasure of teaching alongside Nick Brennan, who is an expert on the book of Hebrews, is going to be helping us as we walk through this. He did his doctoral dissertation on the divine Christology in the book of Hebrews, award-winning work, and is now published by T&T Clark. So we're really enjoying having your expertise as we go through this, Nick. We've been talking here about Jesus being better. Even today, you think, what could be better? People walk away. I mean, man, grew up in the church, let's say, and they think it just isn't valuable what they're walking away from, or what they're walking toward is more valuable, or they've had a bad experience in the church, and they hadn't heard Jesus is better, Jesus is better, Jesus is better than X, Jesus is better than Y. What they heard simply was, be better. What we're looking at here is what can bring people back into the church, just as the preacher here was seeking to bring people back by the message that Jesus is better, better than the angels, better than Moses, better than the typological blessings of the old covenant. Jesus is our great high priest. He's better than the priesthood of the Jerusalem temple. Wow. Why would you want to go back to the types and shadows? Why would you want to go back to the trailer once the climax of the movie has appeared? And this is the ground of our confidence. So that's what we're going to be looking at here. Jesus, our great high priest, the ground of our confidence, Jesus as the one really all of the promises of God were pointing to. So let's get right into it, brothers.
Why don't I go ahead and start? We're going to begin today in chapter 4, verse 14 through 16. And this is what the author writes. Since then, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast to our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need.
We could do the whole episode on that one message. Yeah. I want to play the role of Luther quoter for a moment. Luther, about this passage, said, after terrifying us with the previous material, this passage now comforts us. So that's what we were looking at last episode was, okay, they failed to enter the rest in disobedience. I mean, that was the theme to now this. Something that stands out to me kind of pastorally as a minister, one group is those that are tempted, which we all are. Everyone is tempted. And so the fact that there is this sympathy of overcoming temptation, the place where we don't overcome, that's one. But I also think of people that have been sinned against. There's a, and again, I'm not trying to read things into this, but my wife and I do a lot of work with abuse survivors. In this passage, the idea that Jesus gets it. Again, we're not trying to be too cute with that, where people kind of load that up with, you know, he gets confused about what ice cream flavor he likes too. We're not making it as like shallow, but the fact that he gets the temptation of sin, he gets being sinned against. Mm. He has great sympathy. This passage is one of the passages where I've watched abuse survivors read this and go, oh my goodness, this is shocking. This is scandalous. And then they go through what happened to him. So again, this passage is an enormous proclamation of hope that we have confidence. I mean, just the idea that let us with confidence draw near to the throne of grace. That's not how kings and thrones work. I mean, you don't saunter into the king's throne room. As you know, Tim Keller says, no one wakes up the king at 2 o'clock in the morning asking for water unless you're the adopted child of the king. I mean, what this has a fullness to it.
Well, also, we've been talking about the importance of the ascension in Hebrews. He starts right off again with it. Since then, we have a great high priest. And I wish that didn't confuse us or break it up there with a heading, Jesus, the great high priest. It kind of looks like it's another chapter, you know, another part of the sermon. This is really how all sermons should end, you know, with, since then, we have such a great high priest who has passed through the heavens. Okay, it's the ascension. We have a high priest who hasn't passed through the curtain on earth to minister for us, who, by the way, has to, first of all, sacrifice for his own sins and then for the people. We have a great high priest who totally sympathizes with us in all points like us, yet without sin. But he passed through the heavens, that curtain that the earthly curtain was made to look like, that copy. He passed through the actual original. Jesus, who, yes, was just like us in every way, but Jesus, the Son of God. Because of that, let's hold to our confession. Our high priest happens to be human, so he sympathizes with us, and God, so he can save us.
And you need it, because verse 13, I agree with you, it's really bad when we break these things up. Verse 13, and no creature is hidden from his sight, from God's sight, but all are naked and exposed to the eyes of him to whom we must give account.
So that's
where you
it's
are.
The college of purity.
Amen.
This is the time gospel for the offering. Right. Yeah.
This is where you're left. And to get back to the Luther quote, you are now dead, naked, exposed, guilty. But Christ, you have a great high priest who sympathizes with you so that he sheds his blood to purify you, cleanse you, and raise you to a new life. And now he's the one at the right hand of the Father interceding on your behalf. This is your great high priest.
All right, so we got Nick here.
Yeah, we should talk
to him. I'm curious because we just gushed. We're like, as soon as you read the passage, we're like, oh my goodness, this is so good. And we just start riffing on it.
Now let's ask Nick.
So, hey, Nick, are we far off? But no, seriously.
I think 4:14 through 16 is one of these passages so rich and dense, and it is a high point. A lot of people see it as kind of the end of the first part of the book, and it corresponds to him really coming back to almost the same kind of statement in 10:19, where he talks in very similar language about us having confidence through Christ to approach God, which shows in a sense he's moving in this big idea that really coming to the priesthood of Christ is really what he wants to talk to them about.
Don't think he's left for no reason. When you're talking about what he said that he would come back and he hasn't, and we're still waiting, but I got a temple over here. I have things I can see. Ceremonies that can wash away my sins that I can actually do something about. He's gone. Actually, let me tell you why he's gone, what he's doing right now for your salvation.
Mm. And that he's in the real place. This is the real thing that he's giving you access to. And even the language here about saying, let us approach. I think often we're so used to thinking of that as a metaphor for prayer, which certainly there is stuff about prayer here, but the language of approach means that we now also are like priests through him. Mm. Just as he's gone to God, we have real access to God. And yet he's saying it to people who are struggling, who are almost on the doorstep on the way out of the church. And yet he's saying to them, it's even better than Moses that there's this access to the real place that God is now. But also, I think better than Moses, he's saying, there's not just the way, but then there's the power from Christ to help you walk in that way, to keep going in faith. I think that's what I find amazing about these passages about Jesus as priest, that you'd think that for someone who's on their way out of the Christian faith, to turn with a final glance to Christ would be to find Christ scorning, rejecting. But actually he's saying, look back now, look at Christ, and you can find help there. Mm-hmm. Help to keep going, yes. Help to turn around and repent at the last moment and actually follow him.
It sounds like the doom Christ from medieval spirituality, all the images of Christ, which were already problematic. We already know that. But they were pictures of him. And like there was actually a thing called the doom Christ. Like, hey, you messed up. And Jesus is angry. And he
sword
is
coming out of his mouth. Yeah.
Forward to kicking your butt. He can't wait for it. Like, come on. Like, that's where... from my tradition, the comfortable words were so important. I mean, Cranmer was so intentional about giving words of promise for people that had that doom Christ hovering. And that's what's happening here. I love that. I'm looking at this passage and there's a few things where it's clear that he is genuinely human because he's able to sympathize with our weakness. But there's also this idea that this great high priest is also divine because only God is able to give mercy and grace. Are we supposed to hear great high priest and see fully human, fully divine? Or am I just reading Chalcedon into this and Nicaea? Because the great high priest is different from other priesthood. So talk to me about why is he doing this great high priest? Because he did angels. He's doing Moses. Now, great high priest is, we'll get into that with Aaron and the tradition. But what's the move of using the great high priest language?
Well, certainly he's going to outline how really Jesus is a one of a kind priest. There's only one person in this group, Melchizedekian priest. So I think for him in that lineage, in that kind of priesthood, priest and great priest, high priest are really the same thing. He is the one of a kind priest in that group.
Is part of this apologetic? I mean, people saying that I don't really believe that Jesus could be the Messiah because he is not from the line of Aaron. He can't be a high priest. So all the stuff you're talking about, being a priest, that's all metaphorical. He can't actually be our high priest because he's not from that line. And he's explaining, I know. That was a good line. His line is not a line. His ordination is better.
Yeah, this is the third time, actually, he's called Jesus priest. At least in 1:3, he says, having made purifications for sin, he sat down. Well, that's a priestly action. Then in 2:17, he just briefly called him priest and spoke about his sacrifice. Now he's calling himself priest again, great priest. And then he's going to have to move on and explain, but hang on a minute. How on earth can he be priest? There are already priests. They're Levitical priests. Jesus, we know, everyone knows, was not from the line of Levi. So he can't be a priest. And so he's got to answer that. I think in terms of the question about divinity and humanity, certainly him being a priest, as chapter 5 you go into here, it's clear that he's got to be a man, right? For every high priest is taken from people and is established on behalf of people in matters concerning God. So you've got to be a person. But as you read on, you'll find that all the human priests are beset with the same problem that humans have. So they're great representatives because they're just like humans, but then they've got exactly the same problem, which is a bit like kind of going to court and you find that your lawyer's up on charges as well.
they're doing sacrifices for their own sins first.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So there is this great, wonderful tension, which really Chalcedonian Christology is simply spelling out the logic of, that on the one hand, he's got to be just like us. And on the other hand, he really can't be like us. He's got to be the kind of priest we need, and yet separated from sinners. He's got to be something beyond us. And in fact, even though he stresses here that he's taken from among people, and that applies to Jesus,
Later on, when he talks about Jesus, he'll make this wonderful comparison between mortal people who die. And he uses the word men twice, humans. That is, on the one hand, you have humans who are priests. On the other hand, you have the Son of God. And so when you go, well, hang on a minute, how can he be human? And yet, on the other hand, you contrast him with humans.
Well, that's what I liked about your book. And that's why I asked the question, because, I mean, I'm reading this and I'm thinking, well, I can't help but see God-man everywhere because I've read Anselm and Athanasius and Chalcedon and Nicaea. But what your book did on divine Christology, you're not reading the creeds back into Hebrews. You're pulling this from the text. And we're invited to look at all of these places where that's obvious and clear. And that's where Anselm and Athanasius get it from.
I think so. And Richard Borkham actually has a really interesting part here on 4:14 through 16, which I don't comment on in my book. But he makes much of this idea that now we're coming to the throne. Mm. Well, that's a divine thing. We're coming to the throne of God. And yet, who is it that we meet seated on the divine throne? It's the Son incarnate, risen. Mm. And so all of our coming to God is then conditioned through this person, Jesus.
The Father is in the penthouse and the Son is on the first floor. So we get to crash with Jesus. That's pretty cool. No, Jesus is saying, this is my penthouse. Come on up. I have made a place for you, and you belong here. You belong with me. You guys aren't reading anything into this. This is not,
right.
This is not you know, all of the church fathers against the Arians. This is clearly saying, no, again, in the penthouse is creator. First floor is the angels. This is creator, creature. Even if you have the best high priest in the world, you still have a sinner. Here, you have a man who never sinned, who is your faithful representative, who knows what you're going through, and happens to be the creator, not a creature. Mm.
And certainly that connects to all his language about power, ability of the Son, which is what you need when you really take to heart his warnings of you need, what is it that we need? He says towards the end of the book, you have need of perseverance. Anyone with a sensitive conscience at that point is going to say, well, how can I keep going? It's so hard. And he keeps calling us to say, look at Jesus. Mm-hmm. You can go to him for help. He's powerful. He understands you, but he's got the power to help. I always think that there are two kinds of people in life that we meet. There's people like my mum who would do anything for me, but she doesn't always have the power to sway the situation. And then there's people behind the kiosk on the computer who have the power to change things, but they have no interest in you.
And, I'm thinking the DMV, but
yes,
anyway, yeah.
But always in the Son in the New Testament, in him comes together both power and compassion.
Mm.
So I got a quote from Luther if I can. It's a little extensive, but I think it's helpful at this point. He writes, Jesus Christ is our mediator, our throne of grace, and our bishop before God in heaven, who daily intercedes for us and reconciles all who believe in him alone and who call upon him, that he is not a judge nor cruel, except for those who don't believe in him or who reject comfort and grace, and that he is not the man who accuses and threatens us, but rather the man who reconciles us with God and intercedes for us with his own death and blood shed for us, so that we should not fear him, but approach him with all assurance and call him dear Savior, sweet Comforter, faithful Bishop of our souls. And I love that language, that you have this high priest who's not there accusing you and threatening you, but he's actually reconciled you to God. He's interceding on your behalf. And if we can throw in the Hortonism, he's now invited you into the penthouse to sit down and have a good time with no fear of what may be coming, because you have been reconciled to that God. That's his job as a priest. But I want to ask a question, if you could help me on this. First off, am I pronouncing Melchizedek correctly? And second, what does he have to do with anything? Because there's like a lot made of this very random account in Genesis. This guy, Melchizedek, who shows up.
Yeah. To get to Melchizedek,
yeah, sorry.
I love it because that's where I want to go too. I just want to, for listeners thinking through Melchizedek, so we're looking at passages chapter 5, verses 1 through 10, and chapter 7, verses 1 through 28. And to kind of move in mm-hmm. this direction, I'm looking at Hebrews 5, verses 5 through 9. There's some fascinating stuff on humanity and divinity, I think. So you have... Jesus's deity, which the divine designation of son from verse 5 and verse 8. But then Hebrews seems to underscore the genuineness of his humanity because it's his flesh with loud cries and tears. He's learning obedience. The fact that he suffered as being made perfect, verses 7 through 9. So it sounds like Isaiah 53:3, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, but he's learning obedience through what he suffered, that he would be made perfect, Hebrews 5:9.
And it underscores his act of obedience, right? That this is not just, he suffered for our sins, and so we're forgiven, but he fulfilled the law, and it was hard. It was his delight to get up every day, but there were all sorts of temptations and challenges and obstacles, and he overcame them all. For us, his life matters, not just his death and his resurrection, but his life, because that is imputed to us.
Yeah. He was made perfect in the sense that he became perfectly qualified and experienced to be the source of eternal salvation, verse 9. I mean, so that to me—
Not guy giving us the instructions how to get there, the source of eternal salvation.
So that, to me, that seems like a setup for Melchizedek. Mm-hmm. So again, I just wanted to put that in there to go right back to your question. Can you make sense of Melchizedek for us? Now, I mean, we all have some ideas, but instead of listening to
us talk
about
it, we're going to change the name of this program to Nickelodeon.
Well, certainly, like, so he, in chapter 5, he's spelled out, look, here's some ways you can start to see that I'm not just being flippant in applying priest language to Jesus. You can see what it took for a Levite to be a priest, and that all those things apply to Jesus too, in the way he was called, in the way he actually made offerings, although the offerings here are his prayers. But he wants to make it clear that there is a qualification. He's a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek, 5:10, which is what he really wants to talk about, 5:11. I find that so amazing. This is what I really want to explain to you. I'm getting to the good stuff. Mm. And he moves away, but ultimately he needs to bring them back to that, which is where he then comes back round in 6:20, right? Where Jesus has gone for us. He's gone in as a forerunner on our behalf, according to the order of Melchizedek, having become a high priest forever. And then he's got to remind us, right, hang on a minute, Melchizedek, obscure figure, Genesis 14. And so he starts to remind us in Genesis 14 who this chap was. And he brings out in 7:1-3, just some of the things to refresh our memory. You know, I think he knows his audience perhaps might not remember Genesis 14 as well as other passages in the Bible. And so he says, for this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of God Most High, who met Abraham when he was returning from the battle of the kings and blessed him, to whom also he measured out a tenth from all the spoils. Abraham, first of all, the first measure to Abraham, first of all, is translated or interpreted king of righteousness, then king of Salem, which is king of peace. Without father, without mother, without genealogy, neither beginning of days nor end of life having, he's been made like the Son of God, or being made like the Son of God, he remains a priest forever. And so what he's doing is he's just pulling out all the things that he wants to explain about Melchizedek and then explain why really this is all pointing to Jesus and it's all about him. I think a lot of people's questions about Melchizedek is, isn't this saying some sort of crazy things about Melchizedek, about some figure? And he is a strange figure. But I think the best way to make sense of this is to realize he's not talking straightforwardly about Melchizedek the person, but the portrait of Melchizedek in Scripture. Everyone in Genesis who's anyone as a major figure has a genealogy at the beginning and normally a genealogy at the end too. They begat, and then they died. And these are their offspring who were left behind. And yet this guy, who's greater than Abraham, he's going to say, because he blessed him, appears in the scene of Genesis as if out of nowhere, and then disappears, and we never hear him about him again. So in a literary way, it's like he's this eternal person in both directions, having neither beginning of days nor end of life.
Well, I love it because he's like, okay, greater than Moses, greater than the angels. And to make his point about Abraham, it doesn't say greater. He actually picks Melchizedek, right, who he tithed to, who was a king and priest and a priest forever. What a powerful way to say even greater than Abraham.
And that's the thing, right? Genesis 15, he is met by Melchizedek, Abraham is after battle, successful battle. And it's a ceremony with bread and wine. Huh, that's interesting. and then Melchizedek blesses him. So he takes communion and then is absolved by the, yeah, by Melchizedek. Yeah, yeah. And then he, as you say, Justin, he gives him a tithe, which it automatically says that you are my Lord. He's giving a tax. I mean, who taxes you but your government? He's giving a tax to his suzerain, basically saying, okay, what do I owe you? I'm squatting on your land. I am under your authority. Really? Abraham is putting himself under Melchizedek, and then he has the promise where it's God saying, I will, no ifs, ands, or buts, puts Abraham to sleep. You got to, if you're going to get anything done, you're God, you're going to get anything done, you got to put this guy to sleep. And he has this vision of this ladder with angels going up and down that has, in the history of the church, been interpreted as synergism. You know, how do we climb? In Sunday school, I remember, you know, I am climbing Jacob's ladder, and we make the motion and everything. Wow. But anyway, God is saying, I'm doing it all. Then he walks through the pieces in a self-maledictory oath saying, may I be cut in pieces like these animals if I fail to fulfill this promise I have made to you, Abram. And then same thing with Jacob, you know, puts him to sleep and makes the promise and angels ascending and descending. And then John 1, Nathanael comes to him and Jesus says, you'll see greater miracles than these. You'll see the angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man. That Jesus is saying, I'm the fulfillment of that whole thing. And so is that also similar to what's happening here in Hebrews, that Melchizedek is associated, just as Moses is associated with the angels, with the giving of the law, Melchizedek is associated with Abraham and the giving of the gospel.
Certainly. I mean, he's already in chapter 6 talked about this relationship of Abraham as being the patriarch and the one who has the promises. So to move to Melchizedek here is a bit like that move with Moses, where he's finding this category that's above the highest kinds of people that anyone might think of, these luminaries in the Jewish faith. He's also, I think, trying to explain how it is that Jesus can be a priest when he's not descended from Levi.
He's from Judah.
Yeah.
Right.
So surely that excludes, although even in sketching, notice the way he's already said, well, actually, there is someone in the Old Testament who is both priest and king. That category is there. But people were very concerned about descent for the Levites when they come back from the exile. There's a big question about who can prove they're actually descended from Levi. And lots of criticisms that people had in the first century of the priests who were going on and who they felt were mucking up the temple were because they weren't properly descended and they'd bought the priesthood or stolen it or gotten it on wrong terms. So to be able to say Jesus is priest, he's got to answer this question of descent. And yet he's going to answer it by saying, actually, he's this one-of-a-kind Melchizedekian priest, which is carved out in Genesis 14 as an idea, but he's the one who fills it. And it's not just an excuse. It's got to be that way because he's going to argue that the reason that descent is required with Levi is because they keep dying.
Right.
They can't continue their ministry because they're prevented by death.
They're always standing, but he has sat down.
Exactly. That's the last thing he says.
I think it's also worth noting he's preaching a sermon on Psalm 110. So it's as if the author of Hebrews is saying, I'm not making this up. God promised this. This is actually part of what was promised all along when God preached Psalm 110 about this new priest in the order of Melchizedek. So don't think I'm just sort of finding my one character in the Bible that's going to sort of find the loophole. This was promised from a long time ago, just as it was promised with Abraham.
A priest forever. I mean, that, forever. The language that's straight from, that's Hebrews 5:6 is quoting Psalm 110, right. A priest.
Which is a royal psalm, by the way. It's about a king who's a priest.
Yeah. So the first verse of Psalm 110 is pretty much the most quoted Old Testament passage in the New.
Yep.
The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand. But we don't know anyone else who, like Hebrews at this stage, goes and goes, but hang on a minute. Yeah,
there's more.
He's the one to whom the Lord swore and will not change his mind. You're a priest forever. So how can we have this Davidic figure who is king, you know, but is also sworn priest in the order of Melchizedek?
Yeah. Well, if I could throw in there, I mean, that's such a great point. Hadn't thought about that before. This is a royal psalm, and yet I can't give up the analogy of the penthouse and first floor. So this is, he's doing this with everybody. So that, you know, the angels first floor, you got creature, and then you've got God, penthouse, creator. And he keeps putting Jesus in the penthouse, but he came down to the basement. Is it fair to say he's making the argument here that if you really want to go back to church next Saturday in a copy and basically play house, you're going to see a curtain there that actually looks a lot like heaven. And so that when the high priest passes through, it's not like he's going to do that every Saturday, but you're going to see copies. What I'm telling you is the Levitical priesthood is a copy too. It's a copy ministering in a copy. He passed through the actual curtain, the heavens. He's sitting, again, in the penthouse at the right hand of the Father, and he doesn't have an ordination from earth. He has an ordination from heaven. So if you want to get as high as the first floor, good on you. Have at it. Until, of course, the temple is destroyed and not long after. Then you're really in trouble. But I want to be with the Lord. And the only way I can be with the Lord is if he becomes my brother and lifts me up.
And he makes a big deal about when these things are said. If God starts talking about Melchizedek a long time later after Levi, and someone in that line, it suddenly starts making you question, well, hang on a minute, what's wrong with the Levitical that we have to have another priest?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he does the same with the covenant in Jeremiah. Why do we need a new covenant if the old one's fine?
Yeah.
And so you can imagine people, he's trying to unsettle them. You can't go back. Or if you want to go back, you're going back to something that in a sense its death knell has been rung. Even when these promises came, not just even now when Christ came, but even when the promises came, they were already growing old and pointing beyond themselves.
So the point that you can't go back, I'm thinking of Hebrews 7, 23 through 25. It says in 22 that this makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. And there had to be many Old Testament priests, because as you said, Nick, because they were prevented by death from continuing in office, verse 23. But the Son of God, quote, holds his priesthood permanently because he continues forever, verse 24, having been raised from the dead, which is, this might be the first time the resurrection is brought up. So I'm thinking, like, how does this affect us? And then it goes right into it. It's because it brings us great security of salvation, because Jesus, quote, is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. Verse 25. And so the living Christ, our great high priest, appears in the presence of God on our behalf and presents his finished sacrifice and intercession for us sinners who, quote, draw near to God through him. And so the Father just never rejects us. The security of this is, I mean, it's anchored so strongly. You can't go back. That's why it says, why would you, don't neglect that salvation. I mean, this is so good. Don't go back to the trailer when you have the movie right here. That seems to be a good place for kind of bringing together some of the Melchizedek conversation. Is there anything we're missing before we move?
I would just throw in one more. The whole Melchizedek, Abraham, on one hand, and Moses' Levitical priesthood on the other. So Abraham on one side and the Melchizedek priesthood, Moses on the other side and the Levitical priesthood. Just think back to Romans 4, where Paul says, first of all, if you think that Abraham had some merit, because there was a doctrine of the merit of the fathers, he had some merit. You haven't really read the story very closely. He was justified by faith. Oh, and by the way, you know, he became our father before he was circumcised. You did know that, right? You're clinging to Abraham, and you do realize he was justified. He was declared righteous before he was even circumcised, much less before he had done other things. Abraham is before the giving of the law. Melchizedek, before the giving of the law. And this kind of before the giving of the law is also, that's horizontal, before and after. Before the giving of the law can be seen as above the giving of the law, now seen as a copy of the heavenly sanctuary. I think a lot of people say, oh, Hebrews, he must have been reading Plato. Right. You know, they got the copies everywhere and everything. But the copies are, aren't they kind of turned historically so that you've got Melchizedek lying outside the law being, again, in the penthouse, not the first floor, because he was ordained before the giving of the law. Abraham, justified before the giving of the law. And we are justified apart from the law by that same covenant, the Abrahamic covenant with better promises, better foundation, and a better mediator.
Mike, I think you bring up an excellent and interesting point, really, about how this can be read somewhat platonically. Plato, who would say there's a greater reality and we live in the world of the shadows. But then you come across a verse like 8, verse 5, which says, they serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect a tent, he was instructed by God, saying, see that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain. So, Nick, Mike, I want to turn this over to you. How is that not platonic? And really, what is the author of Hebrews getting at here in chapter 8?
Yeah, I think sometimes throwing kind of Platonism around here is just doesn't really help read the passage. Often people thinking about negative ideas of creation isn't really Plato himself anyway. It's kind of later middle Platonism. And for him, what he's thinking about is this idea that God has a plan in which he's revealed this preparatory sketch and shadow in order to teach us about the real thing, which, yes, is now heavenly, but one day that heavenly space will come in a new creation into which God's people will enter, which comes after this shaking of the whole heavens and earth. So, I mean, he sees the heavens into which we're going to enter as also part of this creation, but it's going to be shaken to produce a new creation. That's what he talks about in chapter 12. So I think we don't really need to think about Plato, and I don't think he explains anything about what he's saying here to do that. Rather, when he appeals, he's appealing to the shape of what's in the Old Testament. He's not appealing to speculation outside of it. All the details here are drawn from paying attention to what Moses saw and what it says in Exodus 25. Now, so he pays really close attention to the way that, to this quotation when it says, you shall make everything according to the pattern that was shown to you on the mountain. And so it wasn't uncommon for Jews of the time, and Hebrews seems to embrace this, to say, in some way, Moses saw into the heavenly space of God, and that was a kind of plan from which he should sketch and kind of make the tabernacle as a copy. But of course, the whole point is you're getting to go into the real thing. When he goes on to describe the nature of the tabernacle in chapter 9, he brings out how it's a place of glory and miracles and divine power. And yet hardly anyone ever gets to go in there. It's like the best space, and yet you don't get to go in. And his whole point is we get to go into not just that inner room, but the thing it was actually patterned after, which is the real deal.
You know, folks, we have confidence not because we have faith in faith. We have confidence because of what he's telling us, because this is better than we ever possibly imagined. Where else but the God-man can we find confidence before God? Think of Job saying, if only I had an advocate, one who could defend me before God. Here it is. I mean, think of other religions. Judaism, angels, closest thing to a mediator. Islam, there is a writer who says in her book, The Smiling Face of Islam, above all, I was influenced by St. John of the Cross, who was in turn quite influenced by Arabic thought. And I found myself in his nada nada nothingness, which was a negative theology. However, I was always terrified by the apparent danger of seeing God in human form. In Islam, there is a problem which is the opposite of this, because in Islam, a person is alone before God. There is nothing they can hold on to, and experiencing this solitude before the absolute sometimes can be difficult. You cannot hold on to Muhammad, because supplicating to him or asking for anything from him is prohibited. Even supplicating to saints is forbidden. You cannot pray to the saints or to the prophet. In this respect, Muslims think that Allah's divinity is so great that even though the prophet is a lofty person, he is far from being as divine as Allah. People can never pray to the prophet or ask anything from him. The divinity of Allah has such an inconceivable quality that no matter how superior, exalted, or wise a person is, he or she cannot approach the degree of Allah. In true Islam, therefore, there is no mediator between Allah and his servants. This is the only place we have confidence. Look at what he's done. He's gone through, not a copy, gone through the actual stars, gone through the heavens that curtain symbolized. He's gone back behind the curtain and has taken his seat. He's not standing, still ministering, cutting open sacrifices and throwing them on the barbecue. He is himself sitting on the throne because he's finished. He's done. And now he's interceding for us. But he's already accomplished our salvation. It's not his nature that's changed, but his status. All along, he was God the Son who assumed our humanity. Good quote from Calvin here on this verse. The ground of this assurance is that the throne of God is not arrayed in naked majesty to confound us, but is adorned with a new name, the throne of grace, not the throne of glory, which ought ever to be remembered when we shun the presence of God. For the glory of God, when we contemplate it alone, can produce no other effect than to fill us with despair. So awful is that throne. So he allures us by draping grace like a banner across his throne.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.